Hello, everyone, and welcome to Literary Loitering. We have another action-packed... What's going on with my accent there?
I don't know.
Action-packed adventure.
It's like West Country Arnold Schwarzenegger.
You don't know what happened there. All of a sudden, the wiring of my brain just went, like, weird. Yes, we have another action-packed adventure. now a bit Irish. Am I going to be able to say the words action-packed? What the hell's going on?
This is a record. This is like the new record for us going off topic. Barely like an entire second into the show.
What we should do right is blame Andy for not introducing the show.
See what happens, Andy. See what happens when you leave it to Rob.
action-packed adventure. Yes, there we go. We have another action-packed adventure for you this week. Anyway, on the show this week, we have a variety of... I don't know. What are you? Who are you? Why are you in
who
my house? Why are you in my house?
who are you, crazy people?
So, yes, over there we have we have Jordan with his windswept and interesting hairdo. And over there, we have the man with the eyelashes, and he's showing them off today. It is Andrew, or Andy, I should say. No, Andy. Have you noticed? When he walked in earlier on today, When Andy walked in earlier today, I looked at him and I thought, there's something different. And it's not that he's not wearing glasses, because I've seen him without glasses before. He's wearing contact lenses. See, he's doing it again. It's the 70s eyes. You know, he's got the bishy eyes on right now.
Oh, my God, he does.
It's like Ziggy Stardust and Eddie Izzard, you know, had a love child.
Okay, we've finally fixed the name problem. I can now be Andrew or Andy, and he is just Anime Drew.
Yes. Oh, sorry, Andy, but...
Also, note how I cunningly made that comment and thus introduced myself.
Yes, I know.
It's like
to prevent
pro-level planning.
To prevent... it basically prevented me from saying anything... we've got all sorts to talk about today. So, guys, what have we got in the news? Because we have a couple of book reviews and a couple of quizzes, a couple of tests even. We've got a lot to get through. So what have we got in the news?
Should we start it off with quite a fun story?
No, I hate fun.
There's going to be a new Shakespeare biography. Or a Shakespeare biography.
Biography, probably a new one, yes. I'm pretty sure he's had biographies done about him before.
It could be a brand new autobiography.
This one is going to be written by Boris Johnson, who everybody knows who he is, as he's authored quite a few books.
Yeah, he's authored quite a few books. How many has he actually written?
Well, no, surely he's got
Churchill.
Can you imagine trying to take notes?
Since when was Churchill a number? I asked how many has he actually written?
He has written Churchill number of books.
Sorry. Churchill is now a number, is it? Okay, so Andrew actually meant...
You know, Churchill 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, so it's one book then.
Everybody knows who Boris Johnson is, but he's got the...
Who is Boris Johnson? Who is this mystery man? You know, who is this mysterious masked man who just rescued us from the...
He's the one with the weird haircut that isn't Donald Trump.
I was doing a Zorro thing there.
That's another story. Before we move on to that, Donald Trump stuff, get away from it quickly.
A bike symbol into people.
No, just a B.
Yeah, anyway, he signed it's 500 grand book deal to write the Shakespeare biography. So somebody has gave him 500 grand.
Give me 5 grand and I'll write it.
So what does actually everybody think this will turn out?
A waste of money.
Oh, definitely.
Definitively a waste of money. I think that Jordan is right. If it were, if you're going to pay £500,000 for somebody to write the biography, it better be Shakespeare writing an autobiography. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure ages 500 to 550 were just fascinating.
Better be. It sounds like some really expensive crayons that this will be written in.
No, no, no. Just basically, it's just like one word on each page, and all it says is brains.
No, no, it's still like, and now here's like the 500-page-long chapter on that one year when there was a worm living in my eye socket.
Yes.
Yeah, but remember, he's writing this book the same time he is Mayor of London.
Yeah, I don't know how that's supposed to work. Doesn't he have a normal job anyway, being Mayor of London, going to meetings, you know, attending parties, having ice cream?
Remember as well.
Oh, God, can you imagine if someone has to, like, write it for him while he dictates it?
Just remember,
oh, God.
Shakespeare!
He is also a favourite, obviously, to replace David Cameron as the leader of the Conservative Party.
That is probably the worst idea the Conservatives could have had since electing David Cameron as the leader of the Conservatives. David Cameron... No, no, since having George Osborne as Chancellor.
Yeah.
Having somebody who doesn't know anything about finance as the person in charge of the finance for the country. Yes, I'm going to cut this and cut that and cut the other because that's the quickest and easiest way of saving money. Let's not focus on strengthening the economy by exporting more because that would cost more money in the short term and apparently we can't afford it.
Should we get Rob
we
off
just
political
have
mode?
Like,
yes, I think we should get Rob off political mode within the next 2 seconds.
You're the one who started with Boris Johnson.
He does write a column for, is it the Daily Telegraph?
Interesting stuff. Next story.
He writes a column for the Daily Telegraph.
So he could be quite qualified to write this Shakespeare.
Have you read the Daily Telegraph column?
No, I honestly do not.
Maybe you should read the Daily Telegraph column before making judgment calls like that. Because it is basically... Andrew, go. What is it? Basically, it's basically the written form of...
I don't know.
What noises does Boris normally... Yes.
With the arms.
Yes.
Can't do it not with the arms.
It's basically the written form of that ending in very nice. So yes, moving on.
Yes, moving on.
George R. Martin. He likes his comic book movies. He likes his comic books. He is apparently an expert on geek culture.
Is he now?
Yeah, I want to know. This is in the Telegraph. I want to know, Daily Telegraph. How do you know he's an expert in geek culture? Does he have a qualification? Because unless he can show me a certificate that proves he is an expert in geek culture, I don't believe it. There are loads of people...
PhD in geekology.
Yeah, there are loads of people who claim they have expertise in geek culture, and it turns out they have expertise. They know about maybe, you know, Trekkies, or they know about video games. Or something like that. Saying somebody's an expert in geek culture.
That's a very
means
broad.
That I can sit down and talk about anime with George R. R. Martin. Can I sit down and talk about anime with George R. R. Martin? Maybe even manga. You know, can he do that? Can he have a conversation with me? Because I've been waiting a long time to have somebody on my level. If he's on my level, we can talk, George. You know, if you're an anime expert, then yeah, we'll talk. You know, let's do lunch, something like that. Be good. But unless he's on
because
that
he
level...
is, of course, an avid listener of the show.
Yeah, but unless he is, you know, unless he is on that level where he's an expert on geek culture across the board, don't call him a bloody geek culture expert. Say he's a video game expert or a expert in fantasy.
But that would mean the Telegraph knew what geek culture actually was.
Yeah, but at least it's not Richard Littlejohn. The Telegraph... At least it's not Richard Littlejohn. Oh dear me. Oh yeah. I mean, we talked about this on the Geek Show yesterday. Just that whole cosplay argument, and then calling that group of women who posed for that photo as different versions of Wonder Woman, calling them all collectively dorpy birds.
Oh, but Rob, we can't criticise him for it because that's his right as free speech.
Yes.
But it's not our right of free speech to criticise him about it.
You know, but it is those women's right to sue his ass for defamation of character, because it clearly is, since number one, he doesn't know any of them. He doesn't know what their jobs are, what their lives are, or anything like that. He doesn't. You see, journalistic freedom of speech under journalism only protects you from the government. So yeah, Richard Littlejohn, we don't salute you. Go to hell. Bye. And I'm not cutting that bit out.
Fair enough.
Freedom of speech.
Yes. Anyway, George R. R. Martin is not happy.
Is he a bit angry? Has it made him go grr?
No, it's not actually made him go grr. He's just not happy. He's disappointed more than he's angry or annoyed or anything like that. He's disappointed because he thinks that Marvel's movies are not really they're not really being all that they could be when it comes to the bad guys. Because Hulk basically fought the Abomination, which was another version of the Hulk. Spider-Man fought Venom, which was another version of Spider-Man. Evil version. Big, scary, tentacled version. Mm. But still just another version of Spider-Man. Captain America fought Bucky Barnes, who's basically evil version of Captain America. Things like that. Ant-Man fought an evil version of Ant-Man.
Yellow Jacket.
Called Yellow Jacket. Mm. You know, it's basically all the heroes are fighting evil versions of themselves. You just kind of, well, why not mix it up a bit? Why not have Hulk fight somebody who he can't actually hit?
Yeah, like, for example, someone who can just dodge all his punches.
Yeah, basically. Someone who can dodge all his punches, or someone who can, you know, who can basically shrink down to the size of, a flea, climb into his ear and start playing Mary Hell on his eardrum. Just go, go a bit samba on his eardrum. That's going to drive Hulk wild, isn't it? He can't do the Hulk clap on his own ear because he'll just knock himself out. Even Hulk knows that. You see what I mean? Ant-Man could beat the Hulk. There is a way. But nobody ever thought, oh, I'll do this.
Yeah, because I've got a bit like, I read a lot of comics and kind of, that's the kind of story I like more.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine when Hulk falls asleep, Ant-Man's just in his ear going, Hulk.
I think, as well, Ant-Man could actually summon all the ants.
You really love Ant-Man, don't you? He's your best friend.
Yeah, and Ant-Man could literally summon all of his ants.
But why? He wouldn't need to. He wouldn't need to summon all the ants. He'd just say, no, I got this. You guys just look after the queen, you know. And then climb into Hulk's ear.
The queen ant.
Yeah.
Not the queen in general.
Yeah, look after the queen. She might be an ant. We don't know. She might be a reptile. We don't know. There is no proof of anything at this point. So, yes. Anyway, George R. R. Martin, he wants them to diversify in their bad guys. I mean, Green Lantern. The bad guy in Green Lantern.
Well, to be fair, he wasn't an evil Green Lantern. He was just a giant poo cloud.
Yes, I know. In Man of Steel, though, he was basically evil Superman. That's basically what he was.
Yeah.
Yes. And Batman? Batman Begins. Ra's al Ghul.
No one mentions that.
Yeah, I guess he was kind of evil Batman.
Yeah. But then Dark Knight, Joker was not evil Batman. Joker was,
Yeah, it's like Batman could easily take down Joker in just a hand-to-hand fight.
Yeah, but Joker prevented that by outthinking him, outsmarting him. I had this discussion with on 4Panel once, and it got kind of heated. I was saying that Joker is basically Joker's psychosis has gone so far around the wheel of insanity. Basically, it started off here where it was fairly normal, and then it went round. And people think that as it goes round, you know, the wheel of insanity, it stops at a certain point and it doesn't go any further than that. I said, no, actually it does. It goes all the way around, and Joker has basically gone all the way through insanity, and he's basically on the calm waters of the other side where he is completely out of control, but also in total control at exactly the same time, because he would not be able to do the things he does if he wasn't both of them at once. The reply I got was, no, Joker is in control all of the time. He just makes it seem like he's out of control. I'm like, well, no. And then the argument was the plans that Joker does. You know, he draws out all those plans sometimes.
Yeah.
But he never puts any measurements on them. That was my argument. He doesn't put any detailed measurements or anything like that, or, you know, weights and stresses. He just basically says, okay, this looks good. We're going to build that. It's an intuitive leap.
So now I really want to see just like the Joker with a tape measure or something.
Yeah, I know. You never see Joker with like a, you know.
Just Harley, hold the other end of that.
Yeah, I know. He doesn't have a hard hat.
Damn it, Harley, don't let it wobble.
Yeah, he doesn't have a hard hat. He doesn't have one of those, you know, laser pointers or anything like that. He doesn't actually have one of those things that scan for wires before he drills.
I don't think Phil, they think that much into it.
How did we get onto this?
Jar Jar Martin.
Sorry, did you just say Jar Jar Martin?
Wow.
And suddenly the voices of 1,000 fandoms screamed out in agony.
I'm going to get killed for that, aren't I?
Yep.
The North is going to remember that one. Oh. Yes, I can add another, fandom to the list of ones that are already trying to kill us. Goodbye, Game of Thrones. It was nice knowing you. Moving on. What else have we got? Who else has got a new story?
I have one that's actually quite local.
Okay.
To us. UK City of Culture. Teesside declares its intention to become to bid in 2025.
Okay. Teesside as a region or Middlesbrough as a town?
Teesside as a region.
Have I missed something? Did Teesside become a city?
It gets more entertaining, right, when you actually read... the Gazette have actually said 15 reasons why we should get it, and you'll actually enjoy the list.
Please, go through.
The list includes Mima.
Okay.
Which certainly has art in it.
Among the world's leading galleries of modern contemporary art, one of the directors.
It's modern art, though, and nobody understands modern art because we look at it and we go, why couldn't you just draw a picture of some fruit? Why do you have to nail it to the ceiling?
The highest attendance meme has ever got was when Top Gear was there.
Yeah, and that's only because they came to see Clarkson and, to a lesser degree, May and Hammond. Okay, next.
Public sculpture. I.e. the Bottle of Notes.
Yes.
Putting on a show, which is Stockton Riverside Festival.
Okay.
International events, such as stuff like Argentina, Brazil, Chile, China, Mexico, Philippines, Serbia, USA. And knowing the football countries to represent, to be represented at Binningham International Folklore Festival.
Okay.
Seafront architecture, which is Stockton Pier, Saltburn Pier.
Saltburn Pier.
Yeah.
I noticed they didn't mention the vertical pier at Redcar.
No, that does get mentioned.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a tower. It's not a pier.
It's not a tower.
From the tuned in.
It's a tragic waste of money.
No. It is a tragic waste of money, and it is not a tower. It has a purple head. It is not a tower.
I know something that has a purple head and is a tower.
Yeah, but that's not it. Unless yours is shaped like that, in which case you may need to see a doctor.
Yes. From the tuned in Young People Centre of the Palace Hub Gallery.
You mean the place that's always empty?
Yes. And of course, the infamous Redcar Beacon.
They're calling it the Beacon now.
They're calling it the infamous Beacon, more importantly.
Bad, isn't
is that, is
bad,
it, does the article
bad.
Say that?
Huh?
Does the article say the infamous?
Yeah.
What's the source that you...
Granted, it's in the Gazette.
Ah.
Granted, the in is in brackets.
Yeah.
So, the infamous Redcar Beacon.
But it's not famous. Yeah.
Home of the new Zetland FM radio station.
Okay.
The seafront's been given an eye-catching new lease of life, apparently.
With what?
Apparently with Redcar Beacon.
Really?
Apparently so.
What have the swept...
Also, what about Saltburn's
aside?
Beautiful preserved seafront? Which you can't argue that one. That one is...
Saltburn has a preserved seafront.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That one you can't argue with. That
Seven
one
coats
is...
of varnish it took.
Yeah.
What's next?
Cutting edge venues.
Like what?
Closing.
The Ark in Stockton, which is the only one that they've actually mentioned.
Is a cutting edge venue?
Apparently so.
Have you been to the Ark?
Yes. Next one, rich history. Hartlepool's maritime experience.
The monkey hangers, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
So what about our history? Hartlepool, why only Hartlepool gets mentioned? There's loads of history. There's loads of history around every other place. Why is only Hartlepool getting mentioned? That's annoying me. Anyway, moving on before I get angry.
Before you get annoyed. Top tunes.
Top tunes.
Top tunes. Chris Rea, Paul Rodgers, David Coverdale, James Arthur, Amelia Lilly, the Chapman Family, Maximo Parks, Paul Smith, Iron Maiden's guitarist, Janet Gears.
Hang on. So... All these aside from Amelia Lilly and
James Arthur,
every other one of them was from like 10 years ago at least.
Yes, apparently so. But I'm assuming the way that they're going for it, like, is the fact that it's someone like you say.
Amelia Lilly sucked. James Arthur sucked.
Yeah. The whole point of like the city culture thing is to stand out from other cities.
The list isn't finished yet.
The list isn't finished.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
World class art, Preston Park Museum and its grounds.
Hang on, world class art in what?
It just says world class art.
Okay.
Because we have to qualify what we put.
Yes.
Yeah.
Preston Park Museum and its grounds, home of the De La Tour's masterpiece, The Dice Players.
Hang on. So
that is Preston, actual art.
Yeah, Preston Park Museum. Yeah. As in the Captain Cook Museum?
No. This is the one that's over Yamway.
Right, okay. The press... yes, I know which one you're on about.
Yeah.
Right, so they didn't mention the Dorman Museum in there.
Dorman Museum's not mentioned. Nothing like that is.
Okay.
It's just the Preston Park one. While the Old Hall and Victorian Street are a perfect example on how to make history come alive, you can also see Larry's description of St. Hilda's at Mima.
Okay.
Just going to put it out there that they mentioned the museum near where I live, but not any of the museums near where you guys live. Yeah.
Yes, I know. I just find...
No, I'm not saying that, you know, we're better than other people.
You can hit them if you want. Engineering genius. Now, this one you can't argue with. Transport bridge.
Can I just ask a question? But what kind of genius builds a bridge like that?
That is true, but...
Well, at the time, a bridge like that, that's not a bridge. Mm. It's a cable car.
Yeah.
Mm.
A genius builds a bridge like that because, I've got too much time on my hands. Yes, it might be a feat of engineering, but it is also a waste of time.
Yeah, but do you know why the transporter bridge is better than a normal bridge?
Why?
Oh, I was kind of hoping you'd tell me.
No. I do love the Transport Bridge, though, because it is an absolute phenomenal piece of engineering.
But that doesn't make...
Look, it's basically a giant gantry crane.
Yeah.
That's all it is. Mm. It's not a phenomenal piece of engineering.
I know you can walk across it, so that's like...
No. I do think it is fantastic.
Look, explain why.
At the time it was built...
When was it built?
1903 or something like that. So it's 103 year old now.
Okay. So it was 1912.
Yeah. Or no. 1911.
1911, okay.
Right. At the time, Teesside being the biggest industry for shipbuilding.
Yeah.
Right, which is why the bridge is built as it is.
Yeah.
To actually allow ships to go back and forth like that, no problem.
Yeah.
So to me, something like that, the fact that you actually have to have all the engineering infrastructure in it itself and all the building work that goes into it.
And it is basically a glorified gantry crane.
Yeah.
That's all it is. Hmm. See, this is the thing. Gantry cranes had been around for about 20, 30 years already.
Hmm.
The transporter bridge is just basically a gantry crane. That's all it is. It annoys me. There's only two bridges of its type in the world. Fine. Yes, okay, it was made at a time when there was lots of shipbuilding. Fine. Got no problem with that. But I hesitate to call it a bridge.
Mm.
A bridge goes over the water, and you know, it's a continuous structure.
Mm.
So they should have basically called it something else.
I'll admit, though...
Transporter ferry.
Most people just call it the transporter anyway, so...
Yes. Anyway, moving on. What else is in this bid for the Teesside City of Culture
More public sculpture. Darlington's brick train was created by...
Darlington? How the hell is Darlington part of Teesside?
So if we get this, does that mean the merge and everything, so...
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like the actual bid for it is actually coming at Darlow, like, which is basically... We are making the bid in Darlow for it.
This is kind of like an Andy Murray situation, isn't it? Where it's like, oh yeah, that good old Andy Murray, that good British player, he's ours... Ours, not Scotland's, ours.
Then he loses, and it's, we don't want him.
Yeah, basically.
Brilliant writers. Thornby born Pat Barker is a Booker Prize winner, while fellow writer Richard Millward.
Richard Millward, who wrote Apples and Ten Story Love Song, neither of which have really, aside from the initial recognition, neither of which have led to any further success.
Ooh, do you know who else comes from Darlington?
Who?
George Mann, author of Ghosts of Manhattan.
Oh, God.
Good laughs from surreal Bob Mortimer to bonkers Pat Monahan. And the real, rather rude Roy Chubby Brown. Teesside does know him.
I think I've heard enough. I don't think you need to go on.
I just want to throw the last... Well, there's two more left anyway.
Okay, very quickly.
Artists. We have done some have done scores of amazing artists.
Like
doing great work. Those stand out. Artists as in actual painted artists or stuff like that. Step forward with Mackenzie Thorpe, whose imaginative, often gritty work epitomizes the art of art of the heart.
Okay. What was the final one then?
The last one is Acting Masterclass. Jamie Bell, Stephen Tomkinson, Wendy Craig, Mark
Jamie
Benton.
Bell isn't from Middlesbrough. Is he from Stockton?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's from Stockton.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mark Benton, Paul Daniels, and not to mention Hollywood director Ridley Scott would put on one heck of a theatrical show too. Just a quick note, Ridley Scott born in South Shields.
Yeah.
So it's whatever.
Oh, close enough.
What about Chubby Brown then? Nobody mentioned
Chubby Brown was Thornaby.
Yeah. Basically,
Bob Mortimer, maybe.
Let me get this straight. The bid is in Darlington.
Yep.
And they're saying Teesside. No. That's what they're saying. Teesside should be going for City of Culture. Not Middlesbrough, not Stockton, not Darlington, where the bid is being placed, but Teesside as a region should be going for City of Culture. Because Teesside is now a city. I don't know where we were when this happened.
Bob Martin, born and Matt in Acklam.
I don't have the words.
But nothing there tells you how we stand out to people that... Well,
from anywhere else.
Because they'll
in
have
the...
their own people that front there.
Did you not hear them, guys? We have Roy Chubby Brown.
And we've had.
But if that doesn't make a City of Culture, I don't know what does.
Yes. Right. Okay. Enough of that nonsense. Let's move on. Let's move on to something else. Right. Okay. So, on a slightly more serious note, Tramp Press have asked authors who are submitting manuscripts to name the writer who inspired them. Or the writers who inspire them, and only 22% of their final results were female. It's one of those announcements that kind of puts a damper on the whole. Mm. You know, yes, publishing is gender equal. Blah 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 blah. Look at J.K. Rowling. Look at Stephanie Meyer. E.L. James. Blah 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 blah. Oh, look, they're big name authors. Yeah, but out of all of the authors, if only a small minority actually make it successfully because they are good at what they do and not because someone picks up a book, sees it's written by a female author and decides not to read it because, it might have a bit of romance in it. I'm sorry, but, that don't fly with me.
But we've had that discussion countless time and time again.
Yeah.
That shouldn't come into any type of context whatsoever.
But you understand why this announcement is concerning. For a lot of authors, if they turn around and say that their inspirations have come from other male authors, then, you know, it's basically this this repeating pattern.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think the main problem is that this push for equality is still relatively recent.
Yeah.
And so all these male authors are, like, more established. So obviously authors are probably going to look to them more.
Yeah. I mean, it is a sad situation, but, I mean, it was only, like, the 1970s and early 1980s when, you know, the late 1970s, early 1980s, when the whole issue of kind of equality started raising its head in society in general. Hmm. You know, it had always been kind of there on the back burner, but it only started becoming a more prominent thing around that time. You know, wanting equal pay, wanting all, you know, all sorts of other equalities. And now we're in a situation where, thankfully, most industries are fairly equal for a given value of equal.
Well, certainly I hope that maybe with future generations of writers coming up now and, like, having more access to female authors, perhaps, if they do this survey, like, maybe a decade's time, it might be a more balanced result.
I think it also goes by the genre that they read, like, they're reading and writing about.
Yeah.
Because if you read something that's a dark, gripping story, chances are it is a male author that's done it.
Lies.
Lies. Most of the ones I've read are male authors.
Yeah, that's because most of the ones that you've picked up are male authors. There are plenty out there from female authors.
Well, the thing is,
there are plenty out there from female authors, but what happens is that, say you have the dark romance section, right? But a female author has written a dark fantasy novel, a pure dark fantasy novel, it'll get shelved with the dark romance stuff.
Yeah.
Because they'll look at it and go, oh, it's a dark fantasy novel written by a female author. It must be dark romance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it'll just get linked to stuff like Twilight.
Yes. Where it might just be a pure dark fantasy. It might be a pure horror fantasy. Mm. Anne McCaffrey wrote loads and loads of science fiction stuff. Right? Loads and loads of science fiction stuff. And some of it was good, some of it was bad, some of it was mediocre, but she established herself as a science fiction writer, you know? But even so, she was still getting treated, even though she was one of the most well-known sci-fi authors around at that point, she was still getting treated, you know, worse than male sci-fi authors were. It's part, not just by the publishing industry, but by people who were going to just go out and buy a sci-fi book. Because they'd look at it and they'll see Anne McCaffrey has written a book called, you know, Pegasus in Flight, or To Ride Pegasus, which was basically the, you know, the prequel to the Tower and Hive series. She wrote a book called To Ride Pegasus, and it was all about psychics, and it was all sci-fi and about psychics and about the development of extrasensory powers, stuff like that. But if you suggested that to a sci-fi author around that time, they go, it's written by a woman, what does she know? And the thing is, mentally, we are all kind of pre-programmed a little bit to think like that. And it's a very sad thing, but it is a thing that we are, that we as men are all kind of pre-programmed to do. I had to put it in those ball terms, but we do it.
Yeah, like, I hate to admit it, but you gave me a book to read, Weirder Shadows Over Innsmouth, which was like an anthology series, and some of the horror writers in there were women, and like, initially was like there was definitely a little part of me that was like, oh, it's a horror story written by a woman, this might not be as good, and like, it weren't. They were some of the best ones.
Exactly. And this is the thing, it's only by reading these books repeatedly, you know, reading as much as you can, that you start breaking down that boundary in your head. Because that boundary isn't something that you put there intentionally, it's something that you were raised with, unfortunately. There needs to be a societal shift. It needs to be a societal shift, and it has to start at home. It can't start in school, it has to start at home. It's like the whole argument about racism. You know, any kind of prejudice is preempted by your home environment. It's preempted by the people around you, and most especially by your parents, your father and mother figures. How they view the world becomes a reflection of how you view the world, because that's how you're raised. If your parents go around effing and blinding about people of a different color, you're going to grow up thinking it's okay to do that. And it's the same if your dad goes around treating women, you know, treating women as if they were, you know, second-hand citizens, second-class citizens. You're going to grow up thinking that, and it will basically colour all of your perceptions, especially when it comes to things like books.
And, like, even in schools, if they teach you that kind of thinking is wrong, it's kind of hard to, like, especially as a child, think, oh, my dad's doing that, he must be wrong. Yeah. Not, these people are saying what my dad is doing is wrong, therefore they are idiots.
Exactly. You know, because your dad is your dad, like it or not. Mm. You know, he can't be wrong. Anyway, that got serious. It's interesting when we get serious.
It is. Also kind of scary. Quick, everyone start making fart noises.
I think we should move on to Andy's next topic.
My next topic?
That next topic. The 10 books.
Yes.
Ah, yes.
The 10 books teachers want you to read. So, Andrew, and remember to speak it to the bike.
As the title implies, really. To note as well, surprisingly, the recent David Walliams children's books aren't on there, and there's no Harry Potter books on there.
Well, no, because they're not books children need to read.
Number 10.
They're just, the books that children probably...
I'll go from 10 to 1, because this goes from 1 to 10.
Yes.
Where the Wild Things Are.
Where the Wild Things Are?
Yeah.
Michael Sendak?
Yeah.
Oh, Maurice Sendak, sorry. Yep.
Number 9, Dogger by Shirley Hughes.
Sorry, what was that?
What?
That is the name of the book, wasn't that? The name of that book is Dogger.
Sorry.
Yeah, D-O-G-G-E-R, Dogger. Wow. That's... Wow.
Wow.
I actually didn't know what it sounds like.
Well... We are now well and truly out of the serious phase.
Oh, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore, Tono.
Have to give that a Google. Just watch yourself.
Well, I think that safely took the serious phase out of all of us, which is fantastic.
It's like, I love the look on all of our faces when he said it the first time. We all just went...
Is that the little pause before?
Yes. And just this deathly silence as we're like, did he just say what I think he said?
I didn't notice it on the list. I looked at it about to say it out and thinking, like, that's not right. Anyway, number 8. Yeah. Right, we're going on a bear hunt by Michael Rawson.
Number 8, yeah.
Yep. Number 7 is The Very Hungry Caterpillar by Eric Carle.
Okay.
That should have been higher.
Number 6 is The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis.
Okay, is this the entire Chronicles of Narnia? Because this is no longer than 10 books.
Yeah, like, I'm guessing this is 16. Just the first one.
There's 7 books in the Chronicles of Narnia.
The Gruffalo by Julia Donaldson.
Okay.
Number 5.
Yeah.
Matilda is number 4 by Roald Dahl.
Can't argue that one.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Okay.
Number 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Number 2 is Goodnight, Mr. Tom by Michelle McGarvian.
Yeah.
And number 1, Charlie and Chocolate Factory by Roald Dahl.
Okay, right. So...
Actually, half of those you can't actually contest.
Well,
because
it depends. Yeah. Are we doing the entirety of the Chronicles of Narnia? Because if that's the case, then yes, there are a couple I can contest.
Oh, no.
I think that's quite a task.
I would assume it would just be Lion, Witch in the Wardrobe.
Hmm.
Did it actually state which?
It is The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis.
Nope. You've got to read all The Chronicles of Narnia.
Yeah, so you have to start off with The Magician's Nephew, which nobody's heard of. And then you go on to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Then you go on to Horse and His Boy with the Talking Horse, who, if I recall, his name was Bree Hee Hinny Brinny Hoo Hee Ha. Yes, the story of Shasta and Aravis. Don't ask me how the hell I remember
this. When you say it like that, you make some of my children's books seem really weird.
Yeah. Don't ask me how the hell I remember these details. I don't know.
I have to give you credit, though, for actually getting them, like, in the right order and everything so far.
Yeah, Magician's Nephew. It was basically Magician's Nephew, Lion, the Witch in the Wardrobe, Horse and His Boy, Prince Caspian, Voyage of the Dawn Treader, The Silver Chair, and the, what was it... Last Battle, I think was the last one.
It was like the last battle of the final battle or something like that.
Basically, the thing is, after Voyage of the Dawn Treader, it started getting really, really trippy. Silver Chair was really dark because you had a prince who'd forgotten his thing, and it was all about hell, you know, hell and stuff like that. And then at the end, the last battle, where you have a donkey who's trying to pretend to be, who thinks that it's basically the god Tash, who's basically the opposite of Aslan, but it's not, because Aslan is both Aslan and Tash at the same time. And there's a false religion springing up, and it goes on to all sorts of weird stuff. And then, you know, a giant reaches out and, you know, grabs the sun and squeezes it, and everybody has to pass through doors and go further in, further up, until they meet the first king and queen, who were there in The Magician's Nephew.
Basically, this is what happens when you huff glue and then read the Bible.
I've done some research, right?
Really?
Dogger. Right?
He's keeping us in suspense. Right?
When Dave loses his favourite toy, Dogger, he is desolate. But then Dogger turns up at school summer fair and everything seems all right until someone else buys him before Dave can get the money.
It takes Dogger on a magical adventure.
Oh, does it go on a magical adventure?
No. It's a magical redneck adventure. It's a cabin on wheels in the woods.
Is this with the vampire rednecks?
Yes.
Suddenly a children's book has just became very
disturbing. Yeah. Yes. Anyway, right, we have a couple of book reviews to do, so I'm going to let Andrew go first.
Okay, good, because this is going to take a while. So I am reviewing Seven Eves, which is like a near 900-page long, gigantic sci-fi epic-y thing.
Yes, it is a tome.
It is. Like, I could drop this on people and kill them with it. So, Seven Eves, basically the story starts kind of at an indeterminate point in the future, but not too far from present society. Basically, the moon explodes.
Right, okay.
So, basically, it explodes fragments into seven different pieces. And the interesting thing is, at first, it's like not actually that huge disaster. Because it is, it's still kind of rotating around its orbit, so you basically still have like the gravitational effects of the moon. It's just, it's like seven lumps instead of one big thing. So like, it basically starts off with all this kind of social media type stuff, but like the government's trying to get out there and just kind of control the situation, turn it into like an interesting science experiment. And this is how we meet sort of the first main character, who is called like Dubois Harris. It was weird, but it's really cool because like, he's basically Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Really?
No, like he actually is, in that like he's this TV astronomer who's basically, his entire job is like explaining science for the masses.
So he's Brian Cox?
No, except like he is Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yes, he is.
Basically, if this were English, he would be Brian Cox.
Yes.
So basically, everything's going fine and dandy. But then, basically, what happens is the chunks of the moon start hitting each other and breaking into smaller bits. And like once they get small enough, they'll fall out of the moon's orbit and fall to Earth. And eventually what will happen is there'll be so many bits, it'll just be like a continual meteor shower on Earth, which will wipe out all life on Earth.
Okay.
So that puts a downer on things. But what they decide to do is basically, they kind of start up a project of kind of refitting the International Space Station to turn it into like a giant space habitat with like a bunch of also mini, they call them arcs. So kind of just floating habitats which kind of float around the International Space Station.
Is this like a prequel to the 100?
Sort of almost, but no.
Okay.
Because this is still
almost, but nah.
Yeah. This is like, we haven't even got to page 100 of the book yet.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's happened in the first 100 pages.
Yeah, yeah.
Impressive.
This is like basically the first part of the book, then it's mostly just about their efforts to try and retrofit the space station to make it into a livable habitat. Like, it's this really densely packed, very scientific, this is how it would actually work.
So this could...
So it's basically gone It's basically gone for like real hardcore science.
Yeah, this is super hardcore, full-on speculative fiction.
All right.
Like, basically, if we were to try and build a space habitat, this is how we would do it.
Hmm.
I was like, it's got some really interesting ideas. Like, the idea is they send up a Russian work team of people who basically live in these giant bubbles, like made up of separate layers.
Yeah.
They're kind of all oxygenated. But obviously, it's incredibly dangerous because bubbles aren't especially resilient to flying space rocks.
Yes.
I didn't see the slight issue on that one.
But it's like, it's this really interesting and kind of quite a stereotypical Russian ideal of them sending up these people. It's like, these people don't matter because they are trying to save the entire human race.
Yeah.
So if like 70 people die, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Mm.
Wow.
Mm.
Yeah. It's really interesting like how it's a combination of that kind of hardcore science and also sort of differing political ideologies. Like, because then you get other countries who are like, oh, no, we have to work out how we can save as many people as we can.
Yeah.
Like,
so have they done the usual thing in this book? Have they done the usual Hollywood thing of, we must not tell the public because it will cause mass panic?
Oh, no, because, like, they tell the public. It's like you also get kind of various public... I think it's actually quite interesting how calm it's portrayed as being...
Yeah, because, I mean, the typical thing with all these disaster movies in Hollywood, I mean, with, like, Armageddon and Deep Impact and stuff like that, it was always, we must not tell the public, they'll panic, blah, 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 blah. And it just kind of highlighted to me just how little faith the politicians have and the establishment has in just normal people to be able to think for themselves.
Yeah, but, like, they do tell, but, like, that kind of ties into what I was saying about how they used public, like social media earlier to talk about the moon's breaking up. They use that again to try and sell people on this idea of, because basically what they also do is send up kind of DNA samples of every race of people on the earth.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, yeah, okay, we're going to die, but our descendants will live on.
Yeah.
Like they actually managed to get it. So lots of people are like, yes, we want to help. Like you even get like massive groups of people building makeshift rockets to help send supplies up.
Yeah. See, that's what I like to see.
And
I think it's a whole new take on the genre.
Yeah.
Like, it's a whole new take on it.
It is.
It's good to see.
Yeah, which this is all nice and fine. And this is part one of the book, which ends kind of with the meteors descending and this really kind of incredibly powerful bit. Like, on the space station, they're listening to radio broadcasts from, like, all around the world, of various cities kind of putting on massive orchestras and stuff.
Yeah.
Just to kind of play out the end of the world.
Wow.
And just gradually each of them goes completely silent.
Wow.
And that's how the first part ends.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. And then we get to part two, where everything goes to hell.
I'm not surprised.
Wow.
Is part two perpetual Scotty mode?
Yeah, basically, it's, oh, God, everything is falling apart. We have to be constantly fixing things.
She can't take it.
And then, kind of, just before the end of the world, that they found out, basically, it turns out, it was all a big lie.
Like, it's a big publicity stunt.
Basically, they were never meant to survive. It's like, because they don't have the supplies to last, like, 5,000 years. They're going to run out of water and everyone will die.
Yeah.
It was basically all big one placebo to, like, keep everyone on Earth calm.
Yeah.
But what happens is this crazy billionaire guy, he goes, right, there's a big meteor over there, like, thousands of miles in space, that's, like, made of water, and that will last people. So what I'm going to do is spend, like, 2 years flying over there, shove a nuclear reactor in it, fly it back to the space station.
Huh. Okay.
Which I love the idea of this kind of crazy spaceship. It's like a giant hunk of ice with a nuclear reactor in the back. So yeah, basically, they eventually make it back, but they all die of radiation poisoning. So kind of a group of the main characters have to go out, kind of bring the ice back to the space station. But while they're going, everything falls apart because basically a villain has snuck up onto the space station. I think it's actually really interesting who they chose to be the villain of the story. because it's the president of the United States.
Really?
Yeah, the idea is she kind of snuck off in like a small rocket to get on board, even though all the leaders of the world basically agreed, we're not going to go up, we're going to go down with the ship.
Yeah.
Because we are essentially useless up there.
There is a comment in that, like, app, it's staying away.
Yeah.
And basically what happens, she gets there, and yeah, basically she finds out, you're not needed here. There's actually nothing you can do to help us, because we need scientists. We need people who are going to help humankind survive for the next 5,000 years. So she ends up basically kind of having a bit of a meltdown.
So basically she has a hissy fit.
Yeah, and what she does is basically, it's an interesting psychological argument that she's so completely dependent on the need to have power that she ends up convincing all the people who don't live on the main space station, like, they're second-class citizens, that, like, they need to rise up and fight for their power, and they end up, like, just flying off in all their little spaceships to go live where they think it's going to be safer. But spoiler alert, it's not. They also, like, nearly all die.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Sorry,
that sounds a very unique...
It's very different to what you'd expect.
Yeah, it's really... Yeah, it like I said, it's different. And, like, basically... Eventually, the survivors of that, who are now, like, basically borderline... Well, no, not even borderline, completely crazy cannibals.
Yeah.
Because they've had to resort. Because, hey, turns out, you don't need legs in space. So that's how we'll live for the next few years. Like, they come back, end up trying to, like, take over the space station, and it all ends in a massive battle. And basically, by the end of it... They have lost the actual DNA samples of everyone on Earth. Instead, what they have is just the genetic data. So they basically need to create like a whole race of clone people. Hmm. And to do that, what they need is women who can give birth to children. Except by the end of the book, there's literally 7 women left who basically have to mother an entirely new human race. And that's the end of part 2.
Wow.
Then we get to part 3, which jumps 5,000 years into the future. Yeah, this is where it gets really crazy.
I think we should leave that one night until next week.
Should we do part 3 next week?
Part 3 for next week, 5 and 6.
Part 3, like, I can talk about quicker because I don't want to spoil most of it.
Yeah.
This is supposed to say the human race has managed to survive and repopulate. And they now live in, like, a giant floating ring of habitats around the Earth.
Yeah.
Which they're now trying to terraform.
Ooh. Okay.
And this part is, like, even more interesting because it's basically taking all the scientific principles from the first 2 parts.
Yeah.
Like, now they actually use them in, like, a big society. Like, I think my favorite one of those is in part 1. Like, you know, I mentioned the Russians who live in the bubble things.
Yeah.
Basically, one of those gets burst, but she has a friend on the space station who decides to save her. So she uses nanobots to, like, form a giant whip.
Yeah.
And, like, lassoes the bubble and pulls it in.
Oh, right.
But now, 5,000 years in the future, they use, like, that same thing as basically, like, giant whips to kind of launch rockets about. Because obviously, they don't have that much water, so fuel is kind of a precious commodity. So they've got all these ideas for non-fuel-based transport.
That's really good.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
Do you know, it sounds like, who is it, Neil Stevenson?
Yeah, Neil Stevenson.
Sounds like they've really put a lot of effort into the world-building for this.
I read the back of the book, and do you know why 7 is kind of such an important number in this?
Why?
Because it took him 7 years to write the book.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
like,
I'm
the
not
back
surprised.
Is just like, and here's this massive list of actual scientists I talked to.
He's done his research.
Yeah.
So he's actually done a bibliography for it as well.
Yeah. It's the kind of book that I'd automatically read.
Yeah.
Which means I'm reading that one next.
It does sound quite cool.
It's really
like
cool.
It justify the size of the book as well.
Yeah.
It's like, that being said, I think you do need to be a pretty committed sci-fi nerd to read it. Because it is, it's very dense, very
for those,
only one of us here has our hands up.
For those who can't see it, Rob has his hand up.
And just, that hand immediately shot up.
Yes. A pretty committed sci-fi nerd.
Yeah.
Hmm. card-carrying, like, card-carrying.
It's the kind of thing that, like, I'd read about 50 pages of and, like, have to put the book down and go have a little think.
Yeah.
Because there's so much in there.
I'd be sitting there. I'd be in my element, wouldn't I?
To read it as it did him to write it.
Oh, and also just a nice little extra is it's got, like, some illustrations at the front and back.
All right.
So, like...
Pictures!
Yay, everyone loves pictures. So, first of all, you have... a big picture of the International Space Station.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And then you also have basically one that's set in the 5,000 years in the future, basically showing you the habitat ring.
Oh, wow.
And then kind of a nice illustration of the elevator thing that they used to get to and from Earth.
Oh, the orbital elevator?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then at the back, they've got a nice piece of art, which is basically... of a giant chunk of what was left of the moon.
Oh, wow. Ooh.
Which was basically where they eventually park the International Space Station. Like, that's really good. Basically the basis for the new society.
Wow, that's so, really
it's
good.
It's a nice little extra bit to have as well.
That just looks really good.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to have fun reading that one.
Mm. Yeah, basically, if you are a sci-fi fan, I would definitely recommend this.
Fantastic.
But obviously, it's not like holiday reading.
Yeah.
Even though I did take it on holiday. But then again, I also read dystopian.
Yes, you were reading Cthulhu on holiday as well.
I was reading Cthulhu on holiday, because that's how I roll.
Yes. Anyway, for my part, I have When the Heavens Fall by Mark Turner, and this is part of the Chronicles of the Exile. Now, I was... quite surprised by this, right? Okay, this is the story of Luca, who is a guardian, and he has returned home after 2 years in 2 years in exile. He turned his back on the guardians and he walked away. Now, a little bit of info about the guardians. They're a bit Jedi. The guardians use this thing called will to which is kind of a superpower type thing, and Luca. There's a growing empire, and the emperor has come, and he basically, when he first arrived, he basically took off his crown and bowed his head at the entrance of the guardian's home, right? Basically, he submitted to himself to the guardians to get their help. But then after that, he kept making more and more demands of them, and eventually the guardians started capitulating to him. Meanwhile, off to the side, he was basically making himself another... order type thing like the Guardians, but these were called the Breakers, which I find ironic because every guild I've had in an MMO has always had the name the Breakers, and I've had that name for like 10 years.
So at the end of the book, did they defeat the Dark Wizard Robber Hawk?
You make it sound like I'm a Terra Hawk. no, they don't. It'd be Archaon. No, unfortunately, they don't. But yeah, the breakers basically have taken over. They're doing what the guardians used to do, and some of the guardians have basically left. The guardians are now a shadow of what they used to be. Right? They used to basically hold the line. They used to be like the Templars in Dragon Age, stuff like that. They used to be the ones who maintained order, like the Jedi type thing. Now they're a shadow of what they used to be. Luca didn't like where they were going, didn't like the fact that the Emperor kept making more and more demands of them, and turned his back on the Guardians and walked away. Now he's back because he's received a letter from the commander of the Guardians, and he finds out the letter isn't actually from him. It's actually from the Emperor. The Emperor wants Luca to find a mage who has stolen a book from the Council of Mages. The book is the Book of Lost Souls, and it is a book that can revive a particular race that has long been dead and should stay dead. Only problem is, the book was stolen at the instigation of somebody else. Now, that third player, right? That third player, because the book used to belong to a character called Shroud. Now, Shroud is basically like a necromancer type person. He's basically an immortal necromancer who has taken on the role of a god. And his magic is all about death. And so the book used to belong to him, but it's been held by this group of mages for a long, long time. And he has always been looking for the book. He didn't know where it was.
Yeah, so is it kind of a, if he gets the book, he'll take over the world type situation?
Not quite. Not quite. It's not quite as simple as that, because Shroud's aims are a lot more complicated than simply taking over the world.
Oh, now that is interesting.
Okay. Then you have the Spider. Now, the Spider is a goddess, and it's interesting the relationship the Spider has to her High Priestess, because her High Priestess is really annoyed at her because her goddess keeps turning up at the High Temple and disturbing her while she's, you know, while she wants to do something else, like put her feet up or have a bath. And, you know, she never knocks on the door and enters politely. She just walks in like she owns the place when it's not
never
her.
Calls in advance.
Yeah, she, you know, her goddess never calls in advance. You know, she just walks into her High Temple, you know, the High Priestess's temple. You know, it's her High Temple, not the goddess's. Yeah. You know, it's hers. Why does the goddess have to walk into her place, you know, kind of thing? You know, messing up all my china and, you know, looking through all my magazines and stuff like that.
Tracking hit legs of mud all over the place.
Yeah, the thing is, she's not an actual spider. But she's called the Spider because she has webs. She has threads all over the place. She's the kind of character who makes, you know, she plays on intrigue and, you know, political intrigue, you know, military intrigue, commercial intrigue, economic intrigue, all that. She plays on all that. And she never plays one side only. She never takes one side only. She basically plays what she sees will be the most advantageous situation for her. And she is the one who persuaded this mage through other means and through a roundabout method. See, he doesn't know he stole the book from the Council of Mages for the Spider. He thought he stole it for someone else. But that person is actually working for the Spider, because she wants the book because she and Shroud hate each other with a passion.
Sounds like there's lots of lovely machinations going on.
There is. It's very Machiavellian. It is very, very Machiavellian. The nice thing is it's not overly descriptive. It just basically dives straight in. This is Luca. This is what he's doing. This is how it starts. You know, you're basically thrown straight into the world. And I quite like that situation. Now, I know it's not appealing to everybody to be thrown straight in, but I like it because you learn more about the world as the story progresses. The problem is Mark Turner is not as good at the dialogue side of things as he is with the pacing and with the narrative structure, everything like that. The dialogue is a little bit chonky at times. It is very, very kind of sword and sorcery dialogue at times.
It is very "so at last we meet again."
Yes, basically. You know, it's very 1970s Conan. No, 1940s Conan, I should say. It sometimes even harks back to Fafner and the Grey Mouse. Let's put it that way. There are occasions when I'm just having, you know, flashbacks of like, but yeah, it's very sword and sorcery in the dialogue, and it didn't need to be. But I can understand why he's gone down that route. It's very kind of a tradition type thing. But it's very centered on the world as it is in there. I mean, in terms of the world building, it's actually not bad. He's gone to a lot of effort to think his way through how the different kind of entities interact with each other. There is one thing that kind of bugged me when you open the book, when you start off, okay, there's the dedication. Then after that, there's the dramatis personae. Right?
Because that's not pretentious.
Yeah, I know. And it caught me off guard because I wasn't expecting it. I was like, why has he done this? I was looking through the list. I was like, yeah, but I don't care about who any of these people are. I don't know them. Why didn't you put this at the back of the book, you know, as kind of a reminder to people, you know, instead of at the front of the book? Because at the front of the book, I haven't read the book yet. I don't know who these people are. I don't care who they are.
Yeah,
just read the book.
A meaningless list of names.
Yeah, I mean, if he put a glossary of terms at the front to help you understand, that would have been more useful.
Yeah, because generally, if like you open the book and says, "Oh, this woman is the Spider's High Priestess," it's like, well, that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, you know, and then just saying the Spider, and you're like, yeah, okay, doesn't mean anything, you know, because when you say the Spider, I'm thinking eight legs, slightly hairy, you know, eats flies, sometimes hides under the toilet seat.
Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies.
Yes, exactly. And this is. It's kind of It's kind of two-thirds of the way, I would say, of being a really, really good story. It's most of the way there. It's just, it kind of falls down at the very last hurdle, which is the dialogue and the slightly pretentious nature, because that is also part of what is in the dialogue. The dialogue is quite pretentious. The relationship dynamics are actually quite good, especially I mentioned the one with the High Priestess and her relationship with her goddess, yeah, the person who she's supposed to be worshipping, right? That's kind of one of the examples of just how the relationships are. They're actually a lot more well realized than I've read in quite a lot of other fantasy works. But it's just when the characters open their mouths to speak, that's when it all starts going a little bit wrong. Not too much wrong, you know. Not too much wrong. It never goes down the route of just kind of going off on one, and they just start spouting drivel, you know, and everyone just starts speaking like in Swahili or something like that. It never goes down that route. So thank God for that. It's a good effort. It's a very, very good effort. As a fantasy novel, it is definitely worth looking at if you are looking for something that has kind of the political and militaristic machinations, you know, has that Machiavellian structure to it. If I was going to liken it to anything, and I think I mentioned this to you, remember I mentioned the Empire trilogy to you?
Yes, you did. You said it was like that.
The Raymond E. Feist, Johnny Wirtz Empire trilogy, which was written, 20 odd years ago. It was very much part of the whole Rift War thing, which centered around the Raymond E. Feist's traditional novel, Magician. It's very much like the Empire trilogy. It is very much based around, you know, the maneuverings of other people, other organizations. Luca may be the main character, but he is often a reactionary element to what other organizations
and
other
people
have done.
Yeah, he's just a cog in a large machine.
Yeah, he's just a cog in a large machine. And the book, you know, the book very clearly shows that. He is just a cog in a large machine. He's just a small piece in a very large world. And I think that's to its credit. Because at the end of the day, he's not supposed to be the big grand hero who's there to save everybody. He is not the Messiah. He is not a savior. He's just a guy who used to be a guardian.
And also a very naughty boy.
Yes.
That was a little bit of my tongue there.
So yeah, that is When Heavens Fall by Mark Turner. It is a recommend from me. I think they could have done a better job with the cover.
Yes.
I don't think the cover needed that.
That is cheesy fantasy.
Yeah. Mm. Cheesy, slightly pretentious fantasy, especially with the lightning coming through the eye. This clocks in at what? At about 550 pages, this clocks in at. And it's pretty good for most of that. So I would recommend this. Yeah, it's good as... it's good as entertainment reading. And one of the best bits of it, as I said, is just the amount of detail he's put into the world. You know, the amount of complexity he's put into the world. That's to its credit.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems like it's a level above the arg. He's trying to sword me, so I'll sword him back even swordier.
Yes, exactly. right, unfortunately, I don't think we've got time for any more because we are at the end of the show there. Yes, we are. We have overrun by a good 10 minutes or so. We will save those for next week.
Yes.
Right,
yes.
We'll save those for next week. I have been right today. We have had Seven Eves by Andrew and When the Heavens Fall by me. Both of them recommends, surprisingly.
Yes, definitely.
So, yes, I have been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
I've been Andy.
And I've been John.
And we'll see you all next week for more literary loitering and possibly other things as well.
Possibly more arguments. There'll be more arguments in it.
Yes.
We never disagree on anything.
I disagree with that statement, Andy.
We always agree to disagree.
Yes.
I'd agree with that.